Welcome to The Leading Tone, a podcast that explores all aspects of all types of music. Today, we discuss 10 more of our favorite composers. I'm Fernando.
And I'm Alex, and welcome to The Leading Tone podcast. Some of you in the audience have to be curious about where some of our favorite composers fall in our top 100 composers list. But before we get into that, let's guess that lick. Guess that lick or don't miss the prize. Welcome to Guess That Lick, our weekly quiz show that tests our musical memory. Each of us will bring an isolated excerpt of music, either from a recording or just a piano track recording, and the other co-hosts will have three listens to Guess That Lick. For a maximum of 5 points per co-host per episode, here is the scoring breakdown. You get 1 point for each of the following: guessing the piece, movement, composer, time period, and genre. This is my week to guess. Last week, Fernando guessed the fourth movement of Sibelius' Fifth Symphony, one of my favorite pieces. Hopefully he was nice to me this week.
Yeah, I think it's very manageable. You're going to be fine, I think.
I accepted at the beginning of this week. I was thinking on my way to work or something. Yeah, I'm going to get 0 points this week.
No, I think you've got it in the bag, but we'll find out. So this time I have a piano reduction of a work, and Alex is going to go ahead and guess it. So let's get right into it. Let's give you your first listen. All right, that's it.
I have a guess.
You have a guess. Okay.
But I'm going to need another listen for sure.
You're going
to make sure.
Listen?
Okay. Yeah, this is tough.
This is tough?
This is tough. Okay.
So here's the second listen. All right, that was the second listen.
All right. So I am going to guess the composer.
Okay.
Benjamin Britten. And the time period, I think, is 20th century. The genre is orchestra. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the movement.
Okay.
But I think the piece is His Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra.
Okay. Those are all great guesses. You're right on the 20th century, and you're right that it is an orchestral work, but you are incorrect with Britten.
Really?
Yeah. It is not The Young Person's Guide.
Give me one more listen.
Yeah. This is the third listen. Okay, that was the third listen.
My other thought might be Shostakovich's Ninth Symphony.
That would be correct.
Wow, okay, yeah. Okay, yeah, Shostakovich's Ninth Symphony. What movement? That really sounded like Britten at first to me.
Mm-hmm. I can see that. I could see where you're coming from with that. Okay. But you got it right now. It is Shostakovich, and it is his Ninth Symphony. So now you're just guessing the movement.
I think that's the first movement.
I think it's the first movement?
Yeah, that's the first movement.
That is incorrect. It is
really
the third movement.
Oh, man. But, oh, that was a good one. Yeah. That was kind of obscure, actually.
Yeah, it's
because
a little
obscure. That one made me think. I thought that it was towards the end of Young Person's Guide a little bit.
Yeah.
Definitely that. The piano sound kind of tricked me there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in the original, it's clarinet and bassoons.
That's why. Okay, because I was like, either this was a line from the string section in the Britten piece, or this was Shostakovich, but that was my second guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you got it on the second guess, and I'll give it to you. So you've got 4 points.
Oh, man, I'm coming just short.
Yeah, 4 points for this week. You've got composer, the genre, the piece, and the time period. You
so
just didn't
that
get
was the fourth movement?
The third movement.
Third movement. Oh, man. And I should have guessed that first, because I know how much you love Shostakovich 9.
Right. Yeah. That is one of my favorite symphonies by Shostakovich, so.
Yeah. Wow. That was a great one. Yeah. So I'll take 4 points for that one, because I really thought that I was going to get none of them there. So the current leaderboards, Fernando is in first place with 5 points, and I'm just behind him in second with 4 points. That's a fun one. Yeah, I had a great time with that one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we hope you all had fun trying to guess that lick with us. Let's go ahead and move on to our next segment, What's New in Music? Mm-hmm. welcome to What's New in Music, where we detail the latest happenings in the music world, from new albums in every genre to our own experiences and listening. Fernando, you want to take it away with the headline?
Most definitely. So our headline today is that the BBC Proms just concluded their series of concerts this past week. And what an incredibly diverse program that they had over the course of the event. The music ranged from classical staples to contemporary classical music to sitar music played by Anushka Shankar, who is the daughter of Ravi Shankar, to the Afrobeat jazz band Coco Roco. A very diverse program and so much fun to listen to. I've watched some clips on YouTube and tried to keep up with it as much as I could throughout the week. But that was definitely a highlight and a big thing this past week.
Yeah, Coco Roco was so cool. And I loved their setup. They had this kind of social distance setup. And man, those guys can play.
Yeah, they can really play. It was really some groovy music, some fun music. If you don't know them, check them out. They're kind of an up-and-coming group from England. Definitely check that out. If you're interested, you can watch some clips of any of the BBC Proms events on YouTube from this year or from previous years. And you can also find their full program online to see what they played. Also notable this week was the release of this album Artemis by the band Artemis. This is a jazz album, jazz group. This is the self-titled debut album on Blue Note Records for them. And we listened to this group for a little bit, some of this album, and it's really great. Like, it's the perfect sample of what modern jazz is like right now, basically, I think. There's a lot of still that older jazz sound, but fused with new ideas and new takes on the jazz genre.
Specifically, the trumpet player has this really, really great sound. It reminds me of Miles Davis or Cliff Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And that it instantly brought me to those recordings. But with that a little bit more modern flair, I really was a huge fan of this. And I'm excited to see what they continue to do in the future. And if they're signed with Blue Note, they've got to be pretty good.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely if you're on Blue Note. But yeah, that is the band Artemis. And their album is also titled Artemis.
Easy to remember. We'll include this in the show description as well. So let's talk about what's going on in our personal music lives this week. Let's start with you, Fernando.
Well, we're back to playing in ensembles. That's really nice and refreshing, I guess, in a way. It's a little bit different with some of the procedures and protocols that we're taking, but overall, it's nice to see people again, nice to make music with other people again. So
absolutely,
that's pretty great. What I'm listening to, though, that's also another great, diverse program, I would say. I was recently exposed to the piece Considering Matthew Shepard by Craig Hella Johnson. It is a choral work. It is just such a beautiful work, and it's so poignant in its message. And if you are unfamiliar with it, I definitely highly recommend listening to it and reading about it, because it has a very strong message about Matthew Shepard and who he was. So definitely check that one out. I've also been listening to some Hindemith piano sonatas and exploring some traditional Japanese music, some taiko drumming, gagaku, which is court music, traditional Japanese court music, and no, which is traditional theatrical music of Japan. So all of that, you know, seemingly random stuff comes up in my listening throughout this past week.
Oh, it's really cool, though. We've been sending stuff back and forth, and all the Japanese stuff, that's been a thread in my listening this week as well. I started with the music of Joe Hisaishi, which we talked about 2 weeks ago in our film scores episode. But then I was also listening to a lot of music by Frederick Delius, like we talked about in our Romantic Piano Concerti episode last week. And his American Rhapsody from Appalachia, March Caprice, and his three small tone poems, all just incredible orchestral works, criminally underplayed and underperformed. Really, really love those.
I'll have to check those out.
Yeah. And then in terms of personal music life, like Fernando said, we are back at school. We are playing in ensembles again, doing some interesting flex band arrangements of some popular pieces like Vesuvius. And I was really surprised and delighted how well the arrangements hold up and they work on the stage. And it was really, really quite nice. So it was nice to have a little bit of that normalcy to offset the last couple months of just being kind of in limbo, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, Japanese music, yeah, that's been a big thread. The music of Princess Mononoke and Howl's Moving Castle is actually what got me to finish the stuffing those music folders. That was a late night. Also been listening to some koto music. That's a traditional Japanese instrument, and really, really enjoying that. And then, completely different from the Japanese music, Mariah Carey's album Emotions. That was her 1991 album, and man, that's a great album. It sounds like Earth, Wind, and Fire, but with the trademark Mariah Carey, the, what is it called, the whistle tones?
Whistle tones,
yeah. Yeah, the whistle tones. So I've been really enjoying that. That was at Fernando's recommendation. Then Carly Rae Jepsen's album Dedicated, and that Dedicated Side B as well.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those I've really, really enjoyed. She has more songs than Call Me Maybe,
right,
if you didn't know.
Yeah, and some of her recent work is just really, really musical and really tasteful for popular music. You know, it has that very pop sound, but it's still very artistic. And I really enjoy that about those recent albums, very recent. I think they came out last year and this year.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that they were all great, and like you said, they're just great pop music. That's kind of our listening for this week, and if you guys have any headlines you want to submit for what's new in music for next week, be sure to hit up our social media profiles on Facebook and Instagram, or our email, theleadingtonepodcast@gmail.com. With that, let's go ahead and get into today's topic.
All right. So we're continuing our list of the top 100 composers, and we're starting with number 21. And who do we have at 21, Alex?
Samuel Barber, born in 1910, passed away in 1981. Very famous American composer. Now let's talk about why he's number 21 on our list, shall we? For me, when you're talking about American composers, the first one you typically talk about is Aaron Copland, right?
Right.
Copland responded to his environment in Paris and America in particular. We talked about that in our last episode. Barber didn't really subscribe to these trends in his music. He looks back to the greats of the 18th and the 19th centuries. This results in stunningly original modern versions of old forms of music. His Adagio for Strings and his Symphony No. 1 in One Movement are king amongst these. Not to mention some of his incredible choral works, with my favorite being Sure on This Shining Night. Other favorites of mine by Barber are his first essay for orchestra, his Commando March for band, his string quartet, and The School for Scandal. The reason I have him ranked lower than Copland on my list is simply because of output, to be honest. I think that Copland just had a few more works that I really, really enjoy. And Barber is one that I'm still discovering, and frankly keeps rising on my list every time I discover a new work by him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally understand that. For me, I think Barber is such an accomplished composer of instrumental and choral music, like you said. And his love of Bach and Brahms specifically is so evident in his music. John Carigliano, a distinguished composer himself, said that Barber's music is an interesting dichotomy of harmonic procedures, an alternation between post-Straussian chromaticism and often diatonic typical American simplicity. And I completely agree with that statement, even though it sounds a little bit academic and highbrow, but Barber took American music in this new direction, and it was a very unique direction and a path that America had not seen in
Absolutely.
Its music, whereas Europe might have experienced a little bit more of that with the branching off from those composers that I mentioned, Bach, Brahms,
yeah,
and stuff. And of course, we still get it in the Americas. We still get that influence, but I think Barber had a very specific route that he was taking his music on, and it really came through, and a lot of people enjoyed his music.
Yeah, absolutely. So to give you a reference, he was ranked number 28 on my list and number 21 on Fernando. So a little bit of a disparity there. I would say he's never quite been my favorite composer. I think that there are works of his that I've really, really enjoyed, but maybe in the future. I'm still going through the massive back catalog of his great choral music, mm-hmm. in particular. And the more I get into that, the more I'm like, okay, he might be one of my favorite choral composers in particular.
Right.
But his symphonic music is just great. There's no problem there in terms of his symphonic output. He's just a composer that really takes a lot of time and investment to get into his works, and it's not as clear where to start with him. But some of our suggestions, like his Adagio for Strings and Symphony No. 1 in One Movement, or Sure on the Shiny Night, probably would be a good place to start. Maybe School for Scandal, too.
Right. Yeah, I think most of those are pretty accessible, with the symphony being a little bit of an exception. I think that one's a little bit harder to listen to comparatively to the others.
Right. Yeah, that one's just so ingrained in our brains. I feel like we talk about that one a lot.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's hard for us not to recommend that.
Mm-hmm.
Couple facts about Samuel Barber. He began writing music at age 7. At age 10, he wrote an operetta called The Rose Tree. So pretty apparent early on that he is very talented. At age 14, he begins studying at the then new Curtis Institute of Music.
Showing his age a little bit there.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
That was he was among the first. And then his travels in Europe, Italy in particular, helped develop his love for the romantic traditions. So that definitely shows in his music. He actually had a brief career as a baritone performing for NBC's Music Guild series, which I thought was quite interesting.
That is really interesting. I've never really thought of that, that he might have done that. So that's really interesting to hear. That must be why he's so great at writing choral music.
Right, yeah. And that was something I didn't start to associate with him until probably the last couple months. And I'm very glad that I did. He commissioned works for the opening of the Lincoln Center, so that's got to tell you that he was pretty well respected as an American voice and American composer. His piano concerto, which also won a Pulitzer Prize, Andrew Marx's farewell for soprano and orchestra, and the opera Antony and Cleopatra. So pretty high profile American composer, and definitely well respected in his time, and continues to be well respected.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Fernando, do you have anything else to add on Samuel Barber?
No, let's move on to number 22, Claude Debussy.
He was ranked number 31 on my list and number 19 on Fernando's. So since he's ranked a little bit higher on Fernando's, I'll let you talk about your rationale first, I think.
With Debussy, he lived from 1862 to 1918, so in that kind of turn of the century period. His works inspired a whole different harmonic language in France and all across Europe. It's super melodic writing with unique harmonies due to his different approach to composition. He kind of didn't use the classical period, you know, guidelines and rules all the time.
Definitely not.
Yeah. And because of his similarities in style between his works, he's a little bit lower than Ravel, who we've talked about, I think, previously. Yeah.
They're pretty comparable in a lot of senses.
Right. But yeah, that's why he's just a little bit lower than Ravel for me, but overall, still love him as a composer, still love a lot of his works. Hopefully we'll be able to talk about some that you might not have heard before. A lot of people are familiar with Clair de Lune or La Mer or something. Maybe we'll mention some other ones. Maybe I think Alex will mention some other ones, it looks like. Let's hear your rationale, Alex.
So number 31 on my list, Claude Debussy, his contribution to harmony in the realm of orchestra and piano allowed for a lot of new soundscapes to be explored. What I love in particular about his music is that it's infinitely more complex than the label of impressionism his music is given. Both him and Ravel were a little bit averse to that label, but Debussy, we'll explain later, might have embraced it a little bit more. Some of his works, Fantasy, Nocturnes, La Mer, Images, Iberia, all of those for orchestra are really masterful works with great use of color, but a lot of variety in terms of his orchestral and piano outputs. But there are a couple of his works that do kind of sound pretty similar to each other. He definitely has that trademark flair to his music. But I think that there is a surprising amount of variety, so I will actually disagree with you there. Let's go ahead and take a listen to a very famous piece by Debussy, La Mer, the first movement a little bit towards the end. Let's take a listen. that was the first movement of La Mer by Claude Debussy. That was towards the end of that movement. Really, really great representative of Debussy's orchestral work in particular. You see and hear some of this wandering kind of sound at the beginning of this excerpt, but then there's this big, glorious arrival. But the harmony is particularly notable because it is very unique for that turn of the century kind of sound. You're starting to hear a little bit more of what makes Debussy Debussy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't say it better myself. That was a perfect explanation of that excerpt. Let's get into some of the composer facts.
Right. So Debussy was admitted to the Paris Conservatory at age 10, received an award for his performance of Chopin's Second Piano Concerto, actually, which we listened to last week on our episode detailing Romantic Piano Concerti. So definitely check that one out if you have not already. So let's talk about Debussy and Impressionism, because Impressionism is what Debussy is so often linked with, and I will say that that is fairly accurate. But there are a couple of factors here at play. So Debussy actually never really went to formal school besides music school. There was this French symbolist movement throughout his late 20s and early 30s that exposed him to poetry and art, and that was a huge influence on his music. And as a result, his education was nearly all in arts and not in the more tangible subjects. So that kind of led him to his fascination with this more esoteric kind of music that ended up just being the mold that his music fit in. But it's a very diverse mold. While a lot of his music can sound pretty similar, and I do agree with Fernando in that sense, there is a surprising amount of variety when you really dig deep in there. And you hear that in his nocturnes, I think, mm-hmm. in particular. Oh my gosh, that is just such a great work. Fernando, do you want to talk about some of his other impressionist works that you like? You're a little bit more familiar with some of these.
Yeah, so I think some other works that really exhibit the impressionistic vibe that Debussy is often credited with are The Girl with the Flaxen Hair and Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun. Both of those have much harder French titles that I can't pronounce. But,
me either.
Yeah, but they are phenomenal works that are very relaxing works and very very much in the style of an impressionist painter, right? It's demonstrating or trying to represent an idea through art, in this case through music, which lends itself well to this quote from Debussy. Debussy said, "You do me a great honor by calling me a pupil of Claude Monet." Claude Monet being the famous painter, that is. As you can see, he's obviously a student of art, and he understands that connection to representing something physical in maybe a non-physical or more esoteric way.
I think you can sense a little bit of sarcasm in this quote, because there was that part of him that did not want his music to be categorized. I think that's kind of a tenet of Impressionism in general.
Right.
Is the lack of emphasis, the lack of categorization.
Right.
It's he does of, love Claude Monet, so right. I mean, he'll take it. He'll be like, fine.
Right, exactly. It's kind of like a backhanded compliment in a way, but yeah, definitely maybe a little bit of sarcasm there, and definitely just Debussy being at least well-versed in art.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have one more quote to read from you from Debussy, which I thought was pretty interesting. There was kind of a shift in his later compositional output where he began to reject more of these artistic influences he had had that is so associated with his music. And he says, "There comes a moment in life when one wants to concentrate. And now I've made the resolution to listen to as little music as possible." So these last couple years of his life is just almost putting up a door to his most well-known compositional output. And I found that really, really interesting. And that's why I say that a lot of his work, well, not a lot of his work, that some of his work does not fall neatly under that umbrella of that Debussy kind of sound.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with that, I think we could talk about Debussy for a long time. Let's move on to a rising star of one of my favorite composers, and if I could redo this list, and we will eventually, I would put this composer much, much higher. And that's Johann Halvorsen, ranked number 17 on my list and number 34 on Fernando's. Halvorsen is the composer closest to the romantic tradition of Tchaikovsky, who is my favorite composer. And his three symphonies, I think, are among the greatest written for a romantic period. Bottom line.
Yeah. So to give you some a little bit of context on when he is living in the romantic period, and his music completely resembles the romantic style, like Alex said. He lived from 1864 to 1935. For me, I just appreciate his great orchestration, really tuneful melodies, well-chosen harmonies, I guess. Very, you know, it still has the chromaticism that is iconic of the romantic period, but it still has... It has a very specific romantic style that is very recognizable, and I really appreciate it for what it is. He's still a very fairly new composer to me, and he was introduced to me by Alex, so I'm still listening and getting deeper into Halvorsen's music.
Absolutely, yeah.
But still massive appreciation for what I have listened to, and like we both have said, very romantic music, very expressive music.
Yeah, and I think you'll definitely hear that in our listening today. I really wish we could listen to one of his three symphonies today, but we've got the next best thing. This is his entry, March of the Boyars, a really, really commonly programmed work for bands in particular. It's a really fun one, and I think you'll recognize some of these melodies most likely. So let's take a listen to Entry, March of the Boyars.
Thank you.
the very romantic sounding entry March of the Boyars by Johan Halvorsen. This was my first gateway into his music. I played it a long time ago in a youth wind ensemble in high school and loved it then. And then this is the piece that led me when I was making this list. Originally, I was like, okay, what other stuff has he written? Because I wanted to put him on this list for the entry march alone. And then brought me to his first symphony. And I think I called Fernando in my office. I'm like, Fernando, you have got to listen to this. This is like the most romantic sounding symphony ever. And that music I'm so hugely passionate about. In terms of this excerpt, I mean, you've got it all in terms of romantic sounds. I think that the woodwind parts in particular kind of show off some of that romantic flair. And the brass fanfare-ish figures are really, really fun. You did hear clapping at the beginning of that excerpt because it's just such a wonderful piece. But I think in reality, I think that was an encore. This is a recording by the Marine Band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably. So let's get into some facts here. Halvorsen was a composer, conductor, violinist, did all of those things, and almost all self-taught aside from some counterpoint lessons in Berlin.
Yeah, I thought that was a really cool fact about him because he wrote some great music, and he wrote it from the heart and not so much from the theoretical or education side of things. So I thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And at a time, he was actually considered to be the foremost violin virtuoso as well as the foremost conductor in Norway. And despite his formal lack of music education, he actually was the professor of violin at the Helsinki Music Institute. So definitely very successful in Norway, and I wish more people would listen to his music. We discussed him pretty extensively in our Nordic Composers episode last month, and I think that he is just such a gem amongst the romantic composers, and definitely one not to overlook.
Right. So, if you're a fan of romantic period music, check out Johan Halvorsen. Now we're going on to number 24 on our list, George Gershwin. George Gershwin. He was 14 on Alex's list, 38 on mine. Gershwin lived from 1898 to 1937. Why so high on your list?
Summertime.
Okay.
Summertime from Porgy and Bess. There's this absurd amount of songs that he's written. Rhapsody in Blue, his Concerto in F, An American in Paris, Cuban Overture, his I Got Rhythm Variations. All of those for orchestra are some of my favorite works. He has such a distinct compositional voice that is the early 20th century equivalent of today's Lin-Manuel Miranda, I feel, in terms of his notoriety as well. I mean, Broadway, everything Broadway was basically George Gershwin at the time. So that, I think that that's a fair and apt comparison. And I just love his music.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. It's so tuneful. For me, he provides this really unique combination of jazz and classical. It's starting to kind of approach third stream music, if you know what that is. And he really seamlessly introduced and incorporated these different cultures into American music or into America through his music. Or like I said before, just so many catchy tunes.
Absolutely.
Just really a fun time listening to Gershwin.
Definitely.
So with that being said, let's take a listen to some of Gershwin's music. This is Rhapsody in Blue. Now, this is a historic recording with Paul Whiteman's band, so it might sound a little bit different than what you're used to hearing from Rhapsody in Blue. Anyways, this is Rhapsody in Blue. Let's take a listen. Thank you. was an excerpt from George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, and wasn't it such a treat to have such a historic recording as our example today?
Right, and I think that it's so interesting, the interpretation of, I'm sure this was recorded the year that this was premiered, because Paul Whiteman did premiere and commission the work with his band. And it's just crazy to me how different the interpretation is of the section that it is with modern orchestras. Modern orchestras tend to take this a lot more of a romantic kind of vibe, and it is a beautiful romantic sounding melody. However, I think that this is a little bit more true maybe to what Gershwin wanted to hear. And obviously, he was involved in this recording too.
Right.
So.
Right. So all of that very possible. And that interpretation is just so interesting to both of us.
Right.
I really love
hearing
the
difference.
So if you've
heard this piece before, then it definitely is a treat.
And if you haven't heard it before, the modern orchestra version, definitely highly recommend that as well.
Absolutely. Do you want to talk about some of his other works, Fernando?
Yeah, so some of his other works are An American in Paris. That's another orchestral work, very popular. He also is known for the song Fascinating Rhythm, and like you said, the I Got Rhythm jazz standard and the variations on that, and the opera Porgy and Bess, which includes the hit Summertime.
I love Summertime.
Yeah. He really began his career, though, as a song plugger in New York City's Tin Pan Alley, and a song plugger is somebody that went around as their job promoting and selling sheet music before good recordings were available. You couldn't really play an MP3 for somebody back then, so he would go.
He brought an MP3 player to somebody in Tin Pan Alley back in that
right,
day.
Right. So he would go and either sing or play the piano to kind of sample these works and say, hey, you should buy this music. It sounds really cool. Listen to this. So that's what he was doing back then, and he eventually transitioned to composing for Broadway with Buddy De Silva and his brother Ira Gershwin. Now, how did he get so good at composing? Well, he studied piano with Charles Hambitzer and composition with Reuben Goldmark, Henry Cowell, and Joseph Brody.
A lot of stuff in common there with Aaron Copland.
Yeah, really. Well, here's another similarity to Copland. He went to Paris, and that's how he got all those sounds in his head for An American in Paris. But he went to Paris to study with Nadia Boulanger, but he was refused. Copland was accepted, but Gershwin was refused by Boulanger, and he was also refused by Arnold Schoenberg.
Huh.
So he wanted to take composition lessons with both of these composers, both of his contemporaries, really, and he was denied by both of them. And Schoenberg even said, or told him, I would only make you a bad Schoenberg, and you're such a good Gershwin already. So, kind of a compliment there from Schoenberg to Gershwin. And I can see his rationale. Could you imagine Gershwin taking the path of Schoenberg and becoming a little bit more serialist with his works?
Right. And we're going to see that in like a couple of different composers on today's list that they nearly studied with composers that could have really influenced their output, but instead they went down a different path. And particularly with these 20th century composers, Schoenberg has a bit of a way of being pretty influential in terms of academic music, and perhaps Gershwin might have gone a more academic route had he studied with Schoenberg. So I thought that
very true.
Interesting there.
Very true. And little fun fact, they were still friends, even though Gershwin never studied with Schoenberg, such good friends that they would actually have weekly tennis matches with each other.
Reportedly, they were not very good.
Yeah, reportedly, they weren't too good. Gershwin apparently looked nervous, and Schoenberg was a little choppy, but they did get together and weekly and play tennis, so a little fun between the two composers.
Yeah, isn't it so interesting, the interactions that are they're presented between these 20th century composers that are so well documented that
right.
They had these friendships. And then in the 19th century, it's more like he said, she said kind of thing.
Right.
But with these composers, I mean, there are cataloged interactions and there are people that are still alive in some cases that remember it's just like, oh yeah, they were really bad at tennis.
Right. And also pictures too.
Yeah.
And for some videos, but yeah, it really humanizes these composers,
right,
where normally you might see them as just this icon or idol, but they were just people too.
Exactly. And speaking of very human composers, number 25 on our list is Vincent Persichetti. Number 24 on my list, 30 on Fernando's. Persichetti has a lot of really interesting stories, but why I have him 24 on my list? Persichetti probably has, in fact, been one of my favorite composers at one point in time. The combination of academic extremes in band music, as well as influences from Stravinsky, Bartok, Hindemith, and Copland, make for a composer that has really particularly grown on me over the years, and I'm actually currently performing with our university, currently performing his Serenade No. 1 for wind band, which he wrote when he was 14. His Symphony for Band has some of the most gorgeous harmonies and melodies in the second movement, and then some other pieces I really love by him are his Divertimento, his Psalm for Band, Masquerade, and Pageant. Those are some of his best representations of his band output. We actually started to dive a little bit deeper into his 9 symphonies. 8 of those are for orchestra, and they're very interesting and very much Persichetti. Fernando, what do you like about Persichetti?
Well, for me, he's such a significant composer for modern band music. Without him, we might not have some of the even more contemporary band music that we have today. And his solo compositions really demonstrate his knowledge of the intricacies of each instrument contributed to orchestration of band music in general, right? He has this excellent mix of more 20th century theory. He even has a whole book about it, but it's still very listenable music, very tuneful music, very catchy music sometimes, but all of these different academic aspects, like you mentioned, that really make it a fun work to dive into a little bit deeper. And that's why I really liked listening today to a little bit more of his orchestral music, because that's not talked about as much. But
oh, no.
It's a really important aspect of his music, too, because it's there and, you know, it doesn't get performed that often because he's kind of pegged as a wind band composer.
Right. And I think that that's selling him short, because his music and his teaching career are really, really significant. Let's talk a little bit about that. He enrolled in the Combs Conservatory at age 5, and then he graduates in 1935 at age 20 and becomes the head of the theory department. So he's already making some pretty big moves there. And then in addition to his immense theoretical background, because he's obviously very skilled in the theory department, he also studied conducting with Fritz Reiner. Thought that was an interesting fact. And then Persichetti actually lived in Philadelphia his whole life. He joined the faculty of Juilliard in 1947, then later becomes the head of the composition department in 1963, and then the literature materials department in 1970. So very successful career at Juilliard. There's this really great article that we're going to link in the show notes for you guys, because Persichetti was just an absolutely wonderful human and wonderful educator that so many students were really, really thankful for. There's some great quotes here. He's teaching this lecture and he would ask, "What was the most exciting event in the history of music?" And he would kind of troll for answers a little bit. People would be like, "The Rite of Spring, the death of Bach." It's kind of your stock answers there, and those are very important events. But Vincent would be like, "No, although those are pretty good, it can't compare to the discovery of the dominant seventh chord. Think about it."
Right.
And I think that he is perfectly apt in that description right there. And he has a lot of those great stories where there's one where they're talking about Bach fugues and his students are like, "Oh, but Bach was Bach, you know," and he's like, "Oh, well, you are you, and we're gonna analyze your fugues next week."
Right.
And so he's just a wonderful human, and there's some fun stories about him.
Right. He seemed to be such a passionate person about music, but also a kind person, and also an animated educator and an
right.
animated person. He seemed to be very energetic and fun to be around, at least. Another funny story, I think, I don't know if this is in the same article, but apparently on his drive from Philadelphia to Juilliard, he would compose in the car while in traffic. So relatively safely, I guess, because, you know, yeah, a lot of stop and go traffic. Yeah. But I've heard that story as well. So a lot of fun stories about Persichetti. I'd also like to bring up, I think we might have missed this, because he studied with Fritz Reiner, he also indirectly studied with Bartok, right? Because Bartok taught Fritz Reiner, and then Fritz Reiner then taught Persichetti later. So that's a really fun part of the composer lineage or family tree, whatever you want to call it.
There's so many of these cool ones, especially in the 20th century, where we can trace back where they studied and who they studied with, and that's just so cool. And Persichetti is a fun one to talk about because of that lineage, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
All right, are you ready to move on, Fernando?
Yes, I am.
All right, number 26, Benjamin Britten. Number 44 on my list and 13 on yours. Fernando, take it away.
Yeah, so really high on my list. I think Britten was very intelligent, has a lot of politically charged music in some cases, a wide range of works in vocal and instrumental fields, and he kind of continued Vaughan Williams' progress in the English music tradition, but in his own way. A lot of careful use of 20th century devices combined with a typically older sounding style. So a little bit of a, maybe a neoclassical take, kind of, in a way, in a lot of his music.
Yeah, for me, Britten's standard is his operas, I think. I think that he writes the best British operas, in my opinion. Very fun and really eclectic music. Additionally, I love his Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra, his variations on the theme of Frank Bridge, the symphonic suite from Gloriana, and his Simple Symphony. Those are some of my favorites. While I don't have Britten ranked as high on my list, I think that he is a very, very significant British composer, but he doesn't measure up to the likes of Vaughan Williams for me personally. Not to say that I don't enjoy his music, though. He nearly passed away when he was 3 months old from pneumonia, and to think that the world could have been deprived of his music so tragically like that is really quite heavy, and he was never expected to make a full recovery physically. He did, and he attends the Royal College of Music, and he was actually admitted to study after a pre-screening by Ralph Vaughan Williams. He intended to study with Alban Berg post-graduation, but the Royal College of Music faculty and his family convinced him otherwise. So that's another one, just like we were talking about earlier. What if Britten had studied with Alban Berg?
Mm-hmm.
That's nuts to me, because you wouldn't have heard so much of what we hear Britten's music as today, I feel like.
Yeah, probably not. And it might have taken maybe an even darker turn, because a lot of Britten's music can get a little dark, but also in this satirical way, right?
Right.
You know, it's often poking fun at, kind of like Shostakovich in a way. It's satirically dark humor, maybe. I mean,
maybe he would have gotten rid of the satire and just gone all dark then.
Right. Or
but that's not Berg's music necessarily.
Right. Yeah. I wouldn't say that's Berg's music, but it maybe would just be a little bit more academic than, I mean, it already was really academic, but it might have been a little bit more, and it might have been a little bit more obviously serial, because that's kind of what Berg was doing.
Right.
I don't know. I feel like it just would have stripped away some of the raw emotion that Britten brought in his own personal style.
Right, some of the more human elements, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Britten is also notable because during fervent anti-homosexual movements during the 1940s and 1950s, Britten was forced to keep his relationship with tenor Peter Pears quiet, and Peter Pears was a huge influence on a lot of his works, so a great icon there, and it's unfortunate what he had to go through. He had a tough life, but he wrote a lot of great music, and he has a great legacy. A lot of great operas, in particular Paul Bunyan, Peter Grimes, and Albert Herring are some of my favorites, and Albert Herring is so unique and so fun, and then Peter Grimes is just really, really great British opera.
Yeah, that one's really, that's one of my favorites as well. I listened to that, fully listened through the whole thing last year, and I really, really enjoyed it.
Absolutely. And British opera is a great way for English speakers to jump into opera in particular, because you can follow along a little bit more. And that's not to say we don't encourage you to try foreign opera as well, because some of the greats are, most of the greats really, are non-English operas. So we definitely encourage you to check out both, but this might be a little bit of a gateway for you to get into opera.
Plus, Britten has a lot of comedy or comedic elements in his operas, so
they're very accessible. Yeah. They're funny, and I did a project on Britten's operas a few months ago for an opera literature course, and I just had a blast doing the research and finding the excerpts to play. There are so many funny ones, and so many of them, I was just like, oh, I want to show all the funny ones, but then there's these moments of great and beautiful, glorious music that I'm like, what do I go with? So I ended up going with a mixture of both. Mm-hmm. I wish we had some listening, but unfortunately there's not any recordings of Britten's music in the public domain that we could play for you guys today. With that, are you ready to move on to another British composer?
Yeah, another British one.
Gustav Holst, number 27. He ranked number 27 exactly on my list and 37 on Fernando's. His Planets, his Suites for Band, Hammersmith, his St. Paul's Suite, the Japanese Suite, a Moorside Suite, a lot of suites, but then his great symphony in F major as well, all really great works. There's a lot of depth to his composition that's been kind of a theme today. A lot of works that aren't programmed often, but his popular works have captured the hearts of so many and are programmed yearly. Find it hard-pressed that the orchestra does not play the Planets at least every 2 years, honestly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, super popular works. For me, they're clever compositions and clever use of folk music in general, drawing upon that like a lot of other composers have. He has more significant band compositions than orchestral compositions, and I tend to listen to a little bit more orchestral music. That kind of brought him down a little bit on my list, but either way, I think they're still great works for the band and for the orchestra.
Absolutely.
And he has a lot of vocal works that I haven't heard yet, and I look forward to listening to more of that, and maybe that'll bring Holst up on my list a little bit more.
We listened to a little bit of his Choral Symphony, and we were really, really enjoying that. So definitely worth checking out his catalog. So many of these composers have such a massive backlog of choral works, and that's why we have a hard time talking about them in depth on the show, because it's such a mammoth task to really be able to sit down and listen to all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And in Barber's case and Holst's case, I think that is huge. And Gershwin, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Gershwin's a little bit easier because you can kind of get away with it if you're in the mood for pop music or
right,
jazz.
Right, yeah, it's a little bit more of that pop kind of sound.
Yeah.
So for Gustav Holst, we have listening for you, the second suite in F, and this is the final movement. So we'll be able to listen to the entirety of it because it's not super long. So you'll get to hear all of this last movement of his second suite in F for military band. Let's take a listen.
Thank you.
That was Gustav Holst's Second Suite in F for Military Band. That was the final movement, and we got to listen to the whole thing, which was great.
Yeah, a rarity on the podcast. Usually we're listening to a lot more long-winded pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But what a treat.
Yeah, what a treat. So we'll get into some composer facts here. He studied at the Royal College of Music with Ralph Vaughan Williams.
Important there.
Yeah, very important. And you can kind of see the influences that Vaughan Williams had on Holst, and maybe some influences on Vaughan Williams' music, right, that Holst had on Vaughan Williams. So,
though they had kind of split trajectories in British music, mm-hmm, I think that it's really interesting that the similarities between some of their works, and particularly some of their earlier works, because both of them wrote band works.
Mm-hmm.
That was early on.
So, The Planets was actually Holst's favorite work of his own. And unsurprisingly, the most popular work, even inspiring John Williams when writing Star Wars,
yes,
as you might be able to tell.
But he's written more than just The Planets.
Right. He is, yeah, plenty more. So we encourage you to go beyond that. But definitely listen to Planets if you haven't.
Absolutely. Holst was also a trombone player. And while he was studying at the Royal College of Music, he played in the Queen's Hall Orchestra under Richard Strauss. Very cool. Richard Strauss is one of my favorite composers, and I thought that was a cool fact. And we were just remarking about how it's interesting that he's a trombone player, because I couldn't really see it, but there's a couple aspects in The Planets that are really cool trombone parts, but I guess he didn't show favoritism, which is good.
Yeah, very good.
He had a pretty extensive education career, the St. Paul's School in particular. He enjoyed teaching young people and passing on his knowledge. So he's very passionate about education, similar to Persichetti, I guess, in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, what a great composer, and what a great work we got to listen to today. I thought that was a really fun one in Holst's catalog, and pretty different than a lot of his works. So definitely worth listening to all of his Second Suite in F for Military Band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And if you listen to The Planets, make sure you listen to all of The Planets, because
yes,
there's so much, there are so many other movements besides Mars and Jupiter, which are the ones that most people listen to, that are just so great.
But Fernando, I thought there was just Mars and Jupiter.
No, there is one for every planet. So
no.
Except Earth.
Yeah. Earth, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that there's been a couple attempts at it. I think people posthumously have tried to write Earth, but I don't think there's been any that really stick.
Yeah, too much of a challenge, really. Earth is, I mean, any of the planets are very unique.
To capture a whole specific compositional style is really hard to pin down. Mm-hmm. And I had a hard time when I was doing the research for this. I'm just like, what is Holst's music really?
Right.
He does have a lot of diversity.
Yeah.
And all of his major well-known works are so different. And even within The Planets is just this huge showcase of a lot of different kinds of sounds for the orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
So really, really great composer with Gustav Holst. Now let's move on to another composer who has a good amount of variety, but is often typecast once again as being this one note composer, when really I think he's one of the most diverse on today's list. Charles Ives, number 25 on my list, 41 on Fernando's, born in 1874, passed away in 1954. This is notable because he is known for his polytonality, polyrhythm, tone clusters, but he does them right, and he does them all in the context of late 19th century, early 20th century, because he doesn't write any works after 1927.
Mm-hmm.
He does not write any more works, and he's just revising at that point. He has an insane depth to his works, and really intelligent, as well as some really surprisingly beautiful works. His six symphonies are great. Two and three are the most famous. I think the finale from his second symphony is just about perfect. One of my favorite symphonic finales ever, that uses a lot of American folk tunes, and it's just really, really fun. That's kind of a trend amongst his music. He does tend to use a little bit of American folk tunes in his music.
Mm-hmm.
Unanswered Question is another one of my personal favorites. And then for band, I love his Old Home Days and Country Band March. I've played both of those, and huge fans of both of those works.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ives for me, although he kind of slipped down a little bit to 41, I still love his music. Very unique and often complex approach in general to his music. And it turned a corner for American music. American music wasn't, it wasn't as secular as some other countries at the time, and right. It wasn't as complex, it wasn't as academic as some other countries at the time. So it's really, it Ives helped turn a corner for American music in that way and inspired a lot of people after him. Right. But I also want to point out, I think like you said, that Ives had much more melodic writing than many people give him credit for.
Oh, yeah.
People know him for the tone clusters, but you have to take a listen to some of his choral music or his vocal music,
mm-hmm.
and you'll start to get a feel for some of the melodies that were going on in his head that he was putting down onto paper. I think that also translates to a lot of his instrumental works as well. So there are some really tuneful melodies, some catchy melodies in the Ives works that a lot of people kind of miss because all of the tone clusters, polytonality, polyrhythms right. around it, they kind of get turned off, I guess, by that.
Yeah, and performers in particular, I think, will bash his works because they're hard.
Yeah.
They're very, very difficult, and they require this immense amount of independence. But Ives was not a musician as a profession.
Right.
Ives worked in insurance for 30 years and composed as a hobby in his free time. We've mentioned he's known for his experimentation, but he does a lot of experimentation on various established forms. And he has this really wide catalog of composition in various styles. His works often took years. He was so meticulous with his revisions, and he also self-published, which was a thing that was really well-respected about him. He is professionally trained, though. He's a professionally trained composer and organist, and his process is really interesting to me because a lot of it is kind of a mystery. Because he was so private, and a lot of the dates for his music are actually a mystery because he did everything himself, and whatever we have is whatever was left over in his manuscripts and whatever he published himself. So I found that to be quite interesting about Ives. And he's a composer that always gets a bad rap, I think.
Yeah, and it's so interesting to me that he was only composing as a hobby, he was working in insurance, yet he has such academically charged music, such complex
more
music.
More so than a lot of these self-proclaimed academics.
Right.
He does it because he has a love and a passion for this academic music, and obviously because he's doing it on writing this enormously complex music while doing insurance.
Right. Right. He's trying to get stuff out. Maybe he just got angry at work that day. And
yeah, he's just like, oh man, I gotta write Country Band March and write this the most angry sounding opening ever. But then you go to his second symphony, the finale, and it's just gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the most serene melodic writing and orchestration I've ever heard.
Yeah. So Ives is one that I'll be checking out, and I hope that everybody in the audience also gives him a chance at least.
Absolutely, yes. People go so surface level with Ives, but dive deep. There's a lot there.
Right, I'm ready to get into some of the vocal music.
Yes, absolutely. Let's go ahead and move on to our next composer on this list. This is Carl Nielsen. We've already discussed him on the podcast. Ranked number 33 on my list and number 33 on Fernando's as well. So funny coincidence there. I think there was a composer I had like left out of my top 25 or something, and then I added him back in, and then it happened to put them in the exact same spot. But so far we're remaining fairly consistent with numbers. I don't think we've had any huge leaps besides maybe Scriabin. But we've already corrected that one for me because Scriabin's going in my top 25 when I make a new list for sure. So, Carl Nielsen, let's get to it. Really powerful romantic period symphonies, and he has this unique flavor that's based off of the music of Denmark. I am really most familiar with his symphonies, and I love all of those. And They're really creative, and I think Fernando mentions here he does a lot interesting with instrument families that hadn't really done before. Fernando, do you want to take it away?
Yeah, so I think that what's so great about Nielsen's music, as we've talked about in the Nordic Composers episode, is that he had such great orchestration, and such excellent and careful, unique use of brass and different families of instruments. A lot of really lively rhythms and very melodic style in general to Nielsen's music. So those are some of the reasons why I enjoy his music.
Absolutely. And we're going to listen to something a bit unique in his repertoire. This is his clarinet concerto. I love this work, and it's a really, really interesting concerto because it begins, well, you'll hear it.
Yeah.
you'll hear how unique it is. We hope you enjoy taking a listen to Carl Nielsen's clarinet concerto. Carl Nielsen's clarinet concerto. Yeah, I wanted to play something a little bit different than his symphonic writing, and I feel like we have listened to a lot of symphonic works on this podcast. This one is quite unique. I mean, we've had percussion, clarinet, and strings. That's it.
Yeah.
Really, really cool instrumentation here, and just a really, really fun excerpt. And the opening is kind of Shostakovich-like a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was interesting and notable.
Yeah, a lot of really fun turns that this piece takes. And like you said, I love that it's such a unique piece compared to what we normally play and what a lot of people normally think of when they think of orchestral music. You don't normally think of the clarinet concerto.
No.
And when you do, sometimes it's more in that Mozart context or in the classical period context.
Right. And this is so unique in that sense because it's not straight-laced at all. I mean, it's very, very unique and very 20th century sounding, really.
Right.
So I really, really enjoy this piece. And definitely worth checking out the whole thing. This is just a very short excerpt of this work.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about Carl Nielsen.
Attended the Royal Academy of Music in Denmark. His primary instrument was the violin, like Hal Fortzen. Primarily viewed as a composer, he didn't have the financial security to dedicate himself to just composition until much later in life. He had a long career in the Royal Danish Orchestra as a violinist, and he taught the Royal Academy of Music in Denmark as well. We've mentioned his six symphonies are his most famous, his fourth, The Inextinguishable, being probably the most performed and the most famous. He has outstanding choral music as well, The Hymn of Love and Sleep, not the Eric Whitaker Sleep. I think I mentioned that on the on the Nordic Composers episode, but the... And we listened to the clarinet concerto, and his wind quintet is also notable as well. Yeah, really, really great works by Nielsen, and definitely worthy of the 29 spot on our list.
Absolutely. So, we're now moving on to number 30 on our list.
Last one, not least, Camille Saint-Saëns ranked number 29 on my list and 43 on Fernando's. Now, Fernando, is that because of output or quality with Saint-Saëns?
Really, I think it's maybe it is the output. I'm not really sure. You know, I think it's a little bit of the style too. Maybe it's
style. Yeah.
Yeah, just a kind of more conservative approach to the Romantic period style, and I think that is it has its place, but maybe it's not my favorite, and that's why it's just a little bit lower. 43 is not particularly low, but still a little bit low, I guess, when we're talking in the 30s and 20s today.
I think that his most powerful pieces are his Carnival of the Animals, Danse Macabre, Samson and Delilah, as well as the Magnificent Organ Symphony. And those pieces alone, I think, are what get him the 29 spot on my list. I can't really say much else for the rest of his works. I mean, I have listened quite a bit into his catalog, and it doesn't grab me as much as those great pieces do. But I can see your point there. I think that his style in general is a little bit more conservative. But those pieces I listed are his least conservative, I would say. Definitely more so in the Romantic tradition. So we're going to close out, not with a bang, but with this gorgeous excerpt from his Carnival of the Animals. This is the Swan, very, very famous excerpt. Let's take a listen to Camille Saint-Saëns' The Carnival of the Animals.
That was The Swan Movement from Carnival of the Animals by Camille Saint-Saëns. And this piece was actually written as a joke and has become quite popular, even being included in Fantasia 2000, the finale was. But Saint-Saëns actually didn't like that it got so popular, and he banned performances of any other movement besides the Swan Movement that we just listened to. So really funny that how that worked out, and how even though he banned these performances, it was still popular enough to be included much later in Fantasia 2000,
right,
with the finale.
The contrarian in me almost wanted to play a movement other than the Swan.
It is all great music, and that's why it was such a great choice to pick any of the movements from Carnival of the Animals, a fantastic work. Now, some other works by Saint-Saëns that you might know, like Alex said before, the Organ Symphony and Samson and Delilah, which is an opera, and Introduction and Rondo Capriccioso for the violin and orchestra.
I'm not that familiar with that one.
But some more facts about Saint-Saëns. In 1908, he became the first famous composer to compose for film, which was quite the feat for the time. He was a big name writing for film, kind of a niche job at the time.
Right. So he's an important start to this great lineage that we have today that we discussed in our film composers episode a couple weeks ago.
That's right. And Saint-Saëns was also highly regarded as an organist. Liszt even went as far as saying that Saint-Saëns was the best in the world at organ. So,
all right.
Yeah, quite high praise from quite a fantastic musician.
Absolutely.
Liszt was a phenomenal pianist in his own right. So, very high praise there. Saint-Saëns' music actually fell out of favor during his lifetime. He was seen as too conservative when Impressionism and Surrealism were beginning to form. He even had a little bit of animosity between himself and Debussy, which is a little fun little fact there. We see a lot of friendships between composers, but this...
Especially the French composers.
Yeah, especially the French composers.
Ravel and Debussy were great friends.
Right, but there was a little bit of animosity between these two.
Oh, you know what? Ravel and Debussy also had a bit of a feud because they distanced themselves from each other when their music was like compared as being too similar.
Right.
So maybe this was the case with Camille Saint-Saëns then. He's like, oh, well, I don't want my music that's a little bit more conservative to be compared to, at the time, was fairly outlandish music compared to what you had been hearing from French music.
So. Yeah. Definitely. Something that we found out actually today.
This is so cool.
Yeah. That Danse Macabre, a very common and well-known work by Saint-Saëns, was originally written for voice and piano, but was later reorchestrated for violin and orchestra, and that's how we hear it now. But we found a recording of the version for voice and piano, and it was very cool.
Very cool and very difficult.
Very difficult, yeah. This would be quite the challenge for any vocalist, I think.
The dictation is insane.
Right.
I think that the words too are it's just so much fun, and I think I might prefer this version now because it gives me this very Schubert vibe, it's very, very enjoyable. I do love the version for violin and orchestra, but having heard that so often and then hearing this version for voice and piano, loved it. I'd love to hear voice and orchestra now.
Right.
I think that'd be really cool.
Yeah, so if you haven't heard the voice and piano version of Danse Macabre, highly recommend that one, as well as all of the other works by Saint-Saëns, including, like we said before, the Organ Symphony, some of the excerpts from Samson and Delilah, and Carnival of the Animals.
Absolutely.
Which we got to hear a little bit of. With that, I'd like to say thanks for listening to us talk about a bunch of our favorite composers, some more in this case. This was the third part of this series where we talk about our top 100 composers. If you missed the last two, make sure to check those out as well. If you want to hear some of your favorite music, let us know.
It's hard to believe that we're coming up on 10 episodes next week.
Yeah, it's approaching quickly.
Yeah, this has been a really, really fun process for us in particular. We love talking about music, and we love talking about music that you guys would like to hear as well. So if you have any submissions for what's new in music or episode topics or Guess That Lick, if you want to send that to us, and we'll see what we can get put on the show and have fun listening to. And thank you all for your support. I think that we've both been really, really happy with the audience engagement and the support we receive from all of you. So thank you all again from the bottom of our hearts. This is such a passion project for us, and and we realize that a lot of this is fairly niche, but to see that there is an audience for this kind of content, we really, really appreciate it. And any improvements that we can make, we'd love to hear from you, because we're always trying to better ourselves and better the podcast.
Right.
So
lifelong learners.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's our motto. So with that, I think we're going to wrap up today's Leading Tone podcast episode. Tune in next Monday for more Leading Tone goodness.
Thanks for listening to the Leading Tone podcast. You can email us at theleadingtonepodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can find us on social media at the Leading Tone podcast with no spaces on Instagram, and the Leading Tone podcast on Facebook.
Thanks again, and tune in next Monday for more of the Leading Tone podcast.